So we're going to be talking today about the question of the additions to the book of Esther that appear in the Greek Bible. Now, everybody probably knows that the Greek Bible is called the Septuagint. Technically, the story that there were 70 scholars applies only to the Torah. And the translation of the Torah began in the 3rd century BCE. The rest of the books of the Bible were translated over time, probably finishing sometime in either the late 2nd century BCE, like 125 BCE, or 100 BCE, something like that. And actually, if you take a look at the handout, at the last thing of these additions to Esther, the one that's called here Additions to Esther 11, which is also known as Edition F, if anybody went to Professor Hittery's presentation. Now, it turns out that when this guy writes that in the 4th year of the reign of Ptolemy and Cleopatra, Dositheus, who said he was a priest and Levite, and Ptolemy, his son, brought the preceding letter of Purim, which they said was genuine, and been translated by Lysimachus, son of Ptolemy, now translated into Greek. Now, this date is probably, because of the particular kings, 114 BCE. So it means that in 114 BCE, one of two things happened. Either only the editions were translated, or more likely, the whole book was translated, and it was translated in such a way as it had the editions that you are looking at here. Let me explain. If you today buy a Septuagint Bible, or a Latin Vulgate Bible, the so-called additions to Esther will appear at the end. Even though if you look at these additions, you will see in 1 minute that they belong in various places in the story, and that if you put them all at the end, you would have no idea what's going on. Just to give an obvious example, the first one on the first page, called Additions to Esther 11, according to this fake chapter number, since Esther ends with 10, this thing is appearing in these today, if you would get a Christian Apocrypha book, or if you would get a Catholic Bible that calls this deuterocanonical, they would be appearing after the 10 chapters of Esther. But this is rather silly, because in fact, each one of these editions comes in a certain place in the book of Esther. To give you an example, the first one, the dream of Mordechai, comes as a prologue. The Edict of Artaxerxes against the Jews, which is here called addition to Esther 13 on the handout, comes after 313. Now these numbers don't mean anything to you, but if you'll look at the text in 1 second, you'll see that these are additions that belong in the middle of the story and not at the end. It's really kind of sort of obvious when we start to read them, which we'll do in a minute. So basically what we're talking about is two versions of Esther, what we could call the original one, which lacks this material, and an expanded one which has this material interfiled. Now, this stuff is written by Jews in the Second Temple period. We're not sure where, or even whether it was written in Greek, or it was written in Hebrew. However, this material reflects the efforts of Jews in the 2nd century BCE, or perhaps the late 1st century, to deal with the fundamental questions of the Megillah that we discuss all the time. The absence of what appears to be a religious message, even though to us when we read the story and look at its structure, we think that the religious message is blatantly obvious and only a fool would miss it. But nonetheless, this argument has been going on for ages, and traditional Jewish interpretation, of course, as everybody here knows, centers on Revach v'Hatzalah Yamod LaYehudim, or various other hints in the Megillah, which are meant somehow to tell us about God's message. For the Hellenistic Jewish reader, this was apparently insufficient. Now, I have two interests in this. One is, we want to find out what did Jews think in Second Temple times about the Megillah, and what did they add, and what did they interpret. That's the first thing we're going to find out when we read these texts. But there's something else really interesting, which is that these texts have a very long resonance in the medieval Jewish tradition, and only with the rise of modern times did the Jewish community give up its interest in these texts. The reason, as we'll see, is that aspects of these very texts survived in a variety of other medieval texts, some specific and unknown, Some, the two Targumim on Esther, because you know there's Targum 1, which is a regular Targum. There's Targum 2. If it says Targum Yonatan, Yonatan ben Uziel, according to the Gemara, only translated the Nevi'im. So whoever translated Targum 1, and then there's a Targum Sheni, which is a very, very long Targum. Then there's Esther Rabbah, where we'll see the Midrash Esther Rabbah, which is actually quite late, absorbed this stuff. And so the bottom line of this is that we can not only look at the ancient Jewish interpretation in Second Temple times of the Megillah and how they tried to answer the questions we all have and fill in the data, but we can also look at the way these materials have a resonance in the Middle Ages, which somehow we lost. And this is not the only example. This isn't the time to talk about this, but there are many things that were lost in the transition from medieval to modern Judaism, some of which are kind of unfortunate. Maybe some of which, like some of the superstitions and things like this, may be for most of us fortunate, but some unfortunate. Now, if you take your handout and you go to the one which is called on the first page, addition to Esther 11. Now, addition to Esther 11 is known also in medieval Hebrew and Aramaic versions. They are originally printed in the Set Batei Midrashot. They can also be found in the back of the Torah Shlema on Megillat Esther, which is a rather common book, and if you don't have, you can get. Now, let me now point out to you, we're going to read this in a minute, that this particular Dream of Esther text does not appear in Josephus. So, I told you there's the original Megillah. I told you that there's this expanded version of the Greek Bibles. Actually, I didn't tell you that there are really two versions of the Greek Bibles, because the expansions are almost all the same. There are two Greek texts, but the expansions are the same in both. However, besides Josephus, this Yosipon. Yosipon is somebody who took parts of Josephus in a Latin version and rewrote it into Hebrew and is quoted by various Rishonim and exists, of course, to this day. You can buy it in a Jewish bookstore and you can read Yosipon. Yosipon was the way Josephus was known to medieval Jews. There are different opinions about what the date is. Leaving that aside, Yosipon in there has this text, even though it's not in Josephus. So this seems to indicate that these additions, again, were part of the medieval Jewish tradition, even when not even seen by Josephus. But let's take a look at this thing. Mordechai's dream. In the second year of the reign of Artaxerxes the Great. Okay, so we're already in trouble. Who is Artaxerxes, and what does it have to do with the Megillah? So you have to know that almost all scholars are convinced that Xerxes I is our Ahasuerus, 485 to 465 BCE. Now, Xerxes I ruled after a fellow named Smerdis, who was actually a revolutionary. And believe it or not, on the 14th of Adar of some previous year, actually, I guess we can tell you what the name is, right? In the year 521, this fellow, Smerdis, was attacked by Darius and a small group of eight or so of his friends. And Darius took the rule back from this pretender who had stolen the kingdom after the death of Cambyses. This is an unbelievably fascinating story, which happens to be in the back of Sefer Daniel of Da'at Mikra. And I can tell you a hysterical story. The name of the month in English is something we'd never recognize because it's like a Macedonian month name or something like this. And the story is translated from Persian. So when I read it in an English book, I had no idea that it took place on the 14th of Adar. And I went once to an engagement party in the White Shul in Far Rockaway. And there was a Rav there from Brooklyn who was a Hasidish Dayan with a Shrival and a Bekesher. It was Motzei Shabbos. And he was introduced to me by one of his members who had met me somewhere, heard me lecture, and the man starts to tell me that he knows what Purim is. And he starts to tell me that if you read this story, it happened on the 14th of Adar. Well, it can't be Purim because the date doesn't work. But this man had this fascinating idea that the revolution that brought Darius I to power kicking out this pretender was actually the original Purim story. Fascinating idea, even though it doesn't seem to be true. But it does give you a sense of the intrigues that were going on in the Persian Empire, into which our story really fits. So anyhow, everyone says that Xerxes the one. Whose Artaxerxes won? 464 to 424, that's Artaxasta, who's also mentioned in the Bible. Now the problem is that it was the opinion of many ancient people, Josephus, the Greek translator, that Ahasuerus was Artaxasta. This is not what scholars believe today, but that was in any case the opinion that our author followed. Let me point out that this opinion, the Midrash has both opinions, because we have one opinion which says Ahasuerus was the father of Darius II. That would be Xerxes, that is to say Xerxes the Great would be, according to that Ahasuerus. And then in Esther Rabbah, in a passage that's very reminiscent of our own text over here, we have the notion that the person involved is Artaxasta. And so it seems that both opinions were held in various traditional sources. And for example, you have over here, Rabbanan v'Rabbi Levi Amar, Rabbi Levi Amar Achashverosh hu Artaxasta v'Rabbanan Amar Achashverosh, meaning Xerxes. So the point is that the two different points of view were being debated, and our text says it's Artaxasta. Let's go on. Okay, no interruptions. We can have questions at the end. I'm going to try to have questions at the end. So on the first day of Nisan, Mordechai the son of Yair, son of Shimi, the son of Kish, the tribe of Benjamin, had a dream. Now you know that our Bibles are divided between Mordechai and Mordechai with the Chataf Kametz. Now, when I was a kid, we said Mordechai, and we had never seen any other Bible. Because all our Bibles were the Bible of Meir Literus, who himself had made the Hebrew Bible that we used. It was everyone's Tanakh in those days. Everyone Tanakh from the Hebrew publishing had been written for the British and Foreign Bible Society to be published with a New Testament to convert Jews. But that was our Bible, before Koren. And Koren came out with Mordechai, and most people switched to Mordechai, which is right, because it's Marduka in Elamite, or whatever the heck the language is, which is copied from Akkadian. But here's the interesting thing. The Greek has Mordechai. So, for what that's worth. Now, the son of Yair, son of Shimi, son of Kish, of the tribe of Benjamin, he had a dream. Now, what I want you to notice is, in order to write this text, the author's got to know stuff beside the dream about Mordechai. Everything he knows from Megillah. He was a Jew dwelling in the city of Susa, a great man serving in the court of the king. That's how the text understands Yoshev Bishar HaMelech, that he was an official of the king. We'll see that later. Okay. He was one of the captives whom Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, brought again right out of the Megillah. Behold, noise and confusion. This is new. Thunder and earthquake, tumult. Two great dragons. I'm not going to interpret the dream now because the interpretation of the dream is in the back of your handout. And we're going to get to it in a second. Came forward ready to fight, roared terribly, the roaring every nation prepared for war to fight against the nation of the righteous. Behold the day of darkness and gloom, etc. The whole righteous nation was troubled, skip down, they cried to God. That's like out of where? It's out of Devarim. You say the Haggadah, and Nitzach al-Hashem al-Lukainu. Same problem comes up. What even Nitzach? Why didn't they pray? Okay. Light came, sun rose, the lowly were exalted and consumed those held in honor. Mordechai saw in this dream what God had determined to do. He awoke, he had it on his mind, sought all day to understand it. Go to the back. Next to the, actually, it's really the last page. The title is on the bottom of the next to the last page of the handout. It says, addition to Esther 10. This one is called F. It's called F. I should have put these letters on here. And it comes after the end of the Megillah. Listen to the interpretation. And Mordechai said, these things have come from God. Now this is happening after it's all over, right? For I remember the dream I had concerning these matters. And if you want to find this dream in traditional sources, there were in the Middle Ages, this dream was preserved. And it's found, as I said, in this text, which is found in Batei Midrashot. And you have the whole Chalom there. And it is not preserved in any of the other texts. But there you do have it, right there. And it's given there in their Hebrew and Aramaic versions that circulate in the Middle Ages. So, okay. The tiny spring which became a river, there was light and the sun abundant. The river is Esther, whom the king married and made queen. The two dragons, Haman and myself. The nations, those that gathered to destroy the name of the Jews. My nation, Israel, cried out to God and were saved. The Lord has saved his people, etc. For this purpose he made two lots, one for the people of God and one for all the nations. Now this sounds like a Dead Sea Scroll. Because there the people of good and the people of evil are all divided, and they're fighting eternally with one another. But, in verse 8, these two lots came to the hour and moment and day. This is already back to the lots of the Megillah. Lots meaning a time lot, that you draw a lot for a date. And whatever one comes out is when you are going to kill the Jews. So anyhow, I don't know if we should make 7 too much like the Dead Sea Scrolls, but it's certainly, the commentators on our text certainly hinted it. These two lots came to the hour and moment day of decision before God and among all the nations. Now you see again here the two lots. You see what I'm saying? So I'm not sure here, is the lot the date, or is the lot the two groups who fight against one another? God remembered the people, vindicated his inheritance, and that they will observe these days in the month of Adar, 14th and 15th of that month, with an assembly, joy, gladness before God, generation forever, ever. So this Megillah, according to this, minus the colophon in Greek, if you went to a Megillah reading in Alexandria. And of course, you know, the Gemara tells us that in Alexandria, the Torah reading was so big, there was a guy waving the flag. So let's assume you had a problem with the Megillah, right? But people went anyhow, because most shuls up to recently, you couldn't hear the Megillah anyhow. So it didn't make any difference. The older people here remember that, right? It was, you know, all the noise of the kids screaming. No one could control anybody in those days. So that was what it was like there. So they waved a flag to tell you, let's make believe they waved a flag, even to tell you when to make noise in the name of Haman, because it was so hard to hear there. And they read you the Greek Megillah. So next to the very end, the colophon, they probably didn't read out loud. Why read out loud? Who translated it, right? You stop the reading right here. So the last pasuk in such a reading would have been pasuk, the verse 10 right here. Okay? So the first edition is the dream, and the last edition is that this dream was fulfilled. Now let's ask ourselves a question. What is the big deal of this dream? It comes right there at the beginning to say that the fundamental issue here is that the forces of evil arrayed against the Jewish people, the forces of evil are essentially all the non-Jews, that God saved the Jewish people, and that he foretold this to Mordechai so that Mordechai and others could defend the Jews against these enemies. Okay? So that's the basic message of the first edition. Now, if you go back to the first page, we have the second edition. Now, actually, this is a mini edition. It's not really an edition. I don't want to take the one that's called Add Esther 12. It's parallel to 21:3-1. I'm sorry, it's parallel to 221 to 31. Now, it's an expansion. If you're looking Targum Sheni, you see almost the same thing. Sounds like this tradition survived. And look what it says here. Now, Mordechai took his rest in the courtyard with Gabata and Tarah, his Bigtan and Teresh, the two eunuchs of the king who kept watch in the courtyard. He overheard their conversation, inquired into their purposes, and learned that they were preparing to lay hands upon Artaxerxes the king. Sounds like the Megillah. And he informed the king concerning them. According to the Megillah, he informed Esther, and Esther informed them. Then the king examined the two eunuchs. I mean, it's not a very good translation there. He didn't examine the eunuchs. He did some type of investigation of the eunuchs, right? And they confessed they were led to execution. The king made a permanent record, and Mordechai wrote an account of them. Wait, that's the thing we never heard of before, right? Mordechai wrote an account of them. What's the account that he wrote down? It's the account that he puts into the Megillah later. Because the Megillah, as you can see, the way it's put together, right, it's obviously put together from things that were collected over time. The king ordered now, look at this, and the king ordered Mordechai to serve in the court and rewarded him for these things. Now we understand why Mordechai is so important, but wait a second, there's a real problem here. It contradicts the Megillah. Because the Megillah says Mordechai Yoshev B'Shar HaMelech, he already earlier sat in the place. But okay, he might have gotten promoted. And Haman, the son of Hamdata, a Bugian. Now I got to tell you something amazing. Who is the enemy? According to the general traditional view, the enemy is this Amalekite, descendant of Agag. Now we have in the updating two different things. The Bugian, which sounds like a boogeyman. We don't know what a Bugion in Greek is. Is it a nation? Is it a word for a bad guy? We have no idea. But let me tell you something really interesting. Some of the alternative versions in Greek, in other versions of the Greek translation, as I mentioned to you before, there are two, have, guess who? The Macedonian. Now this shows you what you're talking about. Who are the non-Jews who threatened Judaism in the period we're talking about? So let's remember, in 323 BCE, Alexander Great conquered the Near East. In 311, his empire was split. almost all the Jews found themselves under two empires, the Ptolemaic in Egypt and the Seleucid in Syria. Those two fought over Eretz Yisrael from approximately 311, right, which is the beginning of what we call Minyan Ashtarot. If you have an old-fashioned ketubah, they go according to Minyan Ashtarot from 311 B.C. Okay, so from 311 BCE to then the kingdom is split. From that date until 198 BCE, there was war after war after war in Eretz Israel over who would control between these two. In 198, the Seleucids came to power. That's Antiochus III. And of course, from there we go, 175 Hellenistic reform, 168, 164, the war, 152, Yonatan, establishment of the Hasmoneans. In there somewhere, who's the enemy? Alexander the Great. Where did he come from? Macedonia. That's where he came from. So that's why the Bugion, whoever they are, and the Macedonians could be Chilufei Nuschaot in the same text. These are the bad guys. The Macedonians symbolize the bad guys. Okay. Now, the next one is the first royal letter. Now, we all know that the first royal letter was sent out of the Megillah. You know, but we know this, Haratzim, Yahud, Yatu, Dechufim, and all this stuff, but we have no idea what it said. I mean, we have a little information. So we're going to see that what happens here is we have a mixture of the Hellenistic letter form, which in fact parallels some letters in 3 Maccabees. This is, it would take us too far afield, but some of the style is parallel in 3 Maccabees. But what's really interesting here is the way the anti-Semitic notions are put forward. They're standard. They fit the Hellenistic era. The language looks like it was written in Greek. And we're going to also, I'm going to mention right now, some of this is parallel in Esther Rabbah and elsewhere. Now, this is a copy of the letter of the great king Artaxerxes to the ruler of the 127, etc. Well, you got all that from Megillah, right? The author knows all that stuff from Megillah. Okay. Verse 2, I've become ruler of many nations, master, not a lady with presumption. Okay. I have determined to set a lies on my subjects in lasting tranquility in order to make my kingdom peaceable and open travel. It's a great idea. I'm going to be a great ruler of a kingdom in peace by having one group of my citizens kill another group. Very smart. Okay. When I asked my counselors how this might be accomplished, Haman, who excels among us in sound judgment, blah, blah, blah. Okay. But attained the second place. That's, you know, from the Megillah. He told us that, look, there's this terrible people, a certain hostile people, who have laws contrary to those of every nation and continually disregard the ordinance of the king so that unify the kingdom which we honorably intend cannot be brought about. This is all right in the Megillah. We understand this people alone stands constantly in opposition to all men. Where did he get this thing over here? Perversely following a strange manner of life, ill disposed to our government, doing all harm. I don't know if anybody here has ever read Against Appian by Josephus, but you really should. Let me just say something about Josephus. If you want to read Josephus, don't read the version that you get for $10 on internet, the Whiston translation. Because it's not in the English language, you'll stop reading Josephus. You have no choice. Go to the library, order an interlibrary loan, the Loeb Classics edition, which also has next to it the Greek. Okay, just you don't know Greek, doesn't matter. Read that translation, because otherwise you don't, some of which was done by Louis Feldman from YU, by the way. But anyhow, you'll never understand it and you'll give up. Now, in Against Appian, it's a polemic against an anti-Semite who lived in Alexandria at the time, but this anti-Semite Appian had quoted every other anti-Semite who existed. Now, among the anti-Semitic notions that are in this letter are allusions that are in Appian that Appian attributes to certain other authors, namely the xenophobia of the Jews. Josephus answers the claim of xenophobia of the Jews by saying, what are you talking about? Anybody who wants to join the Jewish people can join. Sounds a little funny today, but okay. Anyone who wants to join the Jewish people can join. So how can you say we're xenophobic? But this is the xenophobia accusation from the Hellenistic period being answered, first added to the story, and then answered, really, by the Megillah. Okay. Therefore, we have decreed that those indicating you were led as Haman in charge of affairs, blah, blah, shalom, their wives and children be utterly destroyed by the sword of their enemies without pity or mercy. This is editorializing, obviously. To those who have long been and now hostile one day may go down in violence or get rid of these guys, send them to Hades. Of course, Ahasuerus would have never said that, whoever he was, because he didn't believe in Hades. He believed in, you know, some early Persian religion. Okay. As I mentioned to you, this very same thing is found in Esther Rabbah. They give the whole thing. So let me now pause to explain something. different sources relate in different ways to this document. Esther Rabbah seems as if they got it and used it. And I usually don't say that, because most of this kind of literature, like Philo, Josephus, wasn't known to the Chachamim at all. But it looks like Esther Rabbah in parts is almost verbatim. And this is in contrast to the parallel version that exists in Targum Sheni, where they also give you a letter. But the letter they give you is not the same letter as this letter. So they share the interpretive idea that we should make up a letter and say what it says. And they have it on the Sora that there's a letter. But these guys over here, in Esther Rabbah, they have the same letter they have here. Okay, good. Now, from verse 8 on, we get what's called addition C. Addition C is Mordechai's prayer. Now, when does Mordechai's prayer come in the story? Mordechai's prayer comes after 417. It comes when he's about to go tell Esther. He's found out what happened. You know, there are all these midrashim. They called all the kids together, and he got them all to be saying to heal him. So anyhow, according to this, we have his prayer. So he prayed to God according to remembrance all the works of the Lord. He said, O Lord, Lord, King who rulest over all things, universe and the power, there is no one who can oppose thee. Okay. For thou hast made heaven and earth. This all sounds like stuff that we would expect to see. Okay? But then he says in 12, thou knowest all things, thou knowest, O Lord, that it was not in insolence or pride, in any love of glory that I did this, and refused to bow down to proud Haman. Now Mordechai has the following problem. Mordechai is now faced with the responsibility that he started it all. He knows it. You see, he knows what no one else knows. He knows he didn't bow down to Haman, and that's why Haman started to kill the Jews. So he prays to God and said, don't think it's that I did this because I'm a big shot and I wouldn't bow down to Haman for political reasons. He said, have Mordechai. What are you doing over here? You caused the whole persecution of the Jews. So he excuses himself. He said, that's not why. I did this that I might not set the glory of man among the glory of God. Of course, you know, the Midrash had the halachic problem. And the Gemara, what's wrong with bowing to somebody the way, you know, people go like this when they meet people? It's perfectly permissible. So they say he had an idol around his neck and he wouldn't bow. But Mordechai is giving his explanation. And now, Lord God of kings, spare thy people for the eyes of our foes upon us to annihilate us, die, to destroy the inheritance that is thine from the beginning. Do not neglect thy portion, Israel. For thou didst redeem for thyself out of Egypt. Hear my prayer, mercy upon me, etc. Don't destroy those who praise you. That's in Tehillim, like Lo Amethim, Yahweh. If you destroy us, we can't pray to you. All Israel cried out mightily, for death was before their eyes. That's missing in the Megillah. Right? You don't know that from the Megillah. And the idea here is the same one found all over in the Midrashim, that the whole people of Israel assembled to pray. Now, the so-called C continues with Esther's prayer. Now there we have, both in the medieval manuscripts and in the Targum, a version of Esther's prayer. Esther is getting ready to go into Achashverosh. You're going to love what's going to come next in the next edition, D, when she appears. Don't look ahead. Do me a favor. Don't anyone look ahead. Okay. Now, so we have her prayer. And Esther the queen sees in deathly anxiety fled to the Lord. She took off her splendid apparel and put on garments of distress and mourning, and instead of costly perfumes. Remember, what does the Megillah say? Before she went to Achashverosh, she put on all her fancy clothes. She's the queen. Why she got to put on fancy clothes? Because she took them off. Okay. And all this other stuff, tangled hair, all the rest. She prayed to the Lord God and said, Lord, thou art king, help me. Okay. My danger is in my hand. Ever since I was born, I heard the tribe. Now, here it's interesting. You have this woman who, if you read the story literally, is not so attuned to separating herself from the ways around her. Let's be realistic. This is one of the big matters of discussion. You know, Esther becomes the queen and all this stuff, right? How religious was she? This stuff. So here we get the answer. Ever since I was born, I've heard of the tribe of my family that thou, O Lord, didst take Israel out of the nations, our fathers. I sat at the Seder in a fancy hotel. My parents paid $30,000 a year to take us to the hotel. And they told us the Seder within 5 minutes' time before the food was served. And what's going on now? Apparently things aren't working out so well, etc. But nonetheless, it's because we sinned and glorified their gods. You know this whole thing from the very beginning. What are the Jews doing at the banquet? That they weren't eating TV dinners, that they were eating the non-kosher food. And because they participated in the non-kosher food and all the rest of this, this is how it all started. So that's what she says. Now we're in bitter slavery because they've covenanted with their idols to abolish what thy mouth has ordained, etc., etc., etc. Do not surrender thy scepter to what has no being, to something which is to these fake gods. etc., etc. You can all, you'll take this home and read it or whatever. And then it goes on, all kinds of stuff, save us, etc. We have no other helper. And my now let's get over here. Okay, 16. Thou knowest my necessity, that I bore the sign of my proud position, which is upon my head on the days when I appear in public. She says that she hates being the queen, that she has no choice and she can't stand it. I abhor it like a menstruous rag, which is the ultimate impurity. And I do not wear it on the days when I'm leisure. I don't put on that crown because I don't want to be the queen and I don't want to be living with this non-Jew. And thy servant has not eaten at Haman's table. I have not honored the king's feast or drunk the wine of libations, which almost seems to be saying she doesn't drink non-kosher wine or eat non-kosher food. Thy servant has no joy since the day that I was brought here until now, except in you. O Lord, etc., etc., save me. Okay. So what happens now is that Esther is going to get ready, as it says in edition D, which is the one called edition to Esther 15. This is quoted in Esther Rabbah, in Yosifon, clearly taken from Josephus. And this is one of the most interesting parts of the whole thing. On the third day when she entered her prayer, she took off her garments. What prayer? That's added to the Megillah, right? Took off her garments in which she had worshipped and arrayed herself in splendid attire. Then majestically adorned after invoking the aid of the all-seeing God, etc., she prayed again. Took two maids, leaning daintily on one, and the other followed, carried a train. The poor woman fasted for 3 days. So she wanted her maid to walk with her, holding her arm. She was radiant with perfect beauty, looked happy as if beloved, but her heart was frozen with fear. When she had gone through the door, she stood before the king. He was seated on his royal throne, clothed in the full array of his majesty, covered with gold and precious stones, like a Persian king. And he was most terrifying, lifting or awe-inspiring. Lifting his face flushed with splendor, he looked at her in fear and anger. What's the problem? You're going to see in a minute. He didn't know it was Esther. You're not allowed to come in. But she's going to find out she could come in anytime she wanted. She didn't know he didn't know it was her. If he would have sent in a servant, say, Esther's here, he would have said, oh, great. But look what happens. Right? Lifting his face with splendor, he looked in fear. The queen faltered, turned pale and faint, and collapsed upon the head of the maid who went before her. Then God changed the spirit of the king to gentleness. In alarm, he sprang from his throne, took her in his arms, until she came to herself and comforted her with soothing words and said, what is it, Esther? I am your brother, meaning I love you, right, basically. Take courage. You shall not die. Our law applies only to the people. Come near. The poor woman didn't know, according to this version, she can come anytime she wants. She got all scared for nothing. Here, Achashverosh pictures is a nice guy. So why did he glower at her? Because he thought she was some stranger. He didn't know who's coming in. Okay, he didn't have his glasses on. Anyhow, what is it on your brother? Take courage. You shall not die, for our law applies only to the people. Come near. Then he raised the golden scepter and touched it to her neck, and he embraced her and said, speak to me. And he said, she said to him, I saw you, my Lord, like an angel of God. My heart was shaken with fear at your glory. For you are wonderful, my Lord, and your countenance is full of grace. But as she was speaking, she fell fainting. The king was agitated, and her servant sought to comfort her. So you see that Esther is going in there after praying, unlike the regular Megillah. She's going in there in terrible fear of Achashverosh, but Achashverosh is interestingly here painted as not such a bad guy. In fact, these additions do not exactly fit with the stupidity that I pointed out before. What kind of a king gets one group of his citizens to kill another group of citizens in order to get some money when, of course, anybody would know you could get much more tax money from the Jews. And by the way, if you don't believe me, you just have to go and look at what's called the Murashu tablets. There's a big debate about whether the Murashu tablets from this very period in Babylonia, which by this time was a Persian, part of the Persian Empire, whether the bankers are Jewish or only a large number of the depositors are Jewish. But who cares? If you've got a lot of Jewish depositors, right? And of course, Jews had by that time in Babylonia immediately gone in to the traditional Jewish professions. Totally amazing, because the prayer in the Nabonidus from Qumran, right, actually indicates a Jewish doctor. So, a Jewish doctor in Babylonia at that time. So it seems like they just went into all these same professions. But this is an amazing passage, which is fascinating. Now, okay, so as a result of this, Esther wins the day, right? She wins the day, and Achashverosh has to send out a second letter. Now, the second letter fits, if anybody wants to look it up, after 8:12. It's edition of Esther 16, and we call it number E. The following is a copy of the letter. The great king, you know, it says in the beginning of Hashegah and HaKetav and gives a summary. So here you get the letter. The great king honors Xerxes to the rules of the providence, etc., etc. The more often they are honored, it goes on. He says, look, you know, we have a problem here. We honored this guy. We thought he was a good guy. Haman. but it turns around he's basically a bad guy. Okay. And such people never escape God. Verse 5. What have been many of those who were set in place of authority have been made in part responsible for the shedding of innocent blood? Governments can yield the death of citizens who are innocent. Now this is the Jews speaking the Hellenistic period, right? By the persuasion of friends who have been entrusted with the administration of public affairs, that you want to figure out how can it happen that me, Achashverosh, a good king, could end up giving an order to kill my own citizens? I was led down the garden path by this evil man. When these men, by false trickery of their evil natures, beguiled the sincere goodwill of the sovereign. He told me the Jews hate everybody, and my own queen is a Jew, and I didn't know that. Sounds a little silly, but okay. What has been wickedly accomplished through the pestilent behavior? That goes on. Okay. For the future, we care to render our kingdom quiet. And then he goes on, and he says the following. For Haman, in verse 10, the son of Hamdata, a Macedonian. That's what I told you before. Really an alien to the Persian blood, quite devoid of our kindliness. Having become our guest, so far enjoyed the goodwill until he came up with this crazy thing, and he wanted to get these people killed, okay. But then in 13, and with intricate craft and deceit, he asked for the destruction of Mordecai, our savior, and perpetual benefactor, and Esther, the blameless partner of our kingdom, together with their whole nation. He thought that this way he would find us undefended and transfer the kingdom of the Persians to the Macedonians. Now, Xerxes, the real man, won. Spent most of his life fighting the Greeks. Not exactly the Macedonians, okay? This is the Peloponnesian Wars. This is Herodotus, right? So apparently, that's what's being reflected over here. Because the Macedonian Persian, that is to say the Hellenistic versus Persian border, which was essentially met the rivers, the Euphrates River, was the scene of constant strife during the Hellenistic period between the Seleucids and the Persians. And this was constant, as it would soon become strife between the Romans and Persians, known as Parthians, who took over afterwards. Okay. But we find the Jews who were consigned to annihilation by this thrice accursed man are not evildoers. They're great people. They have righteous laws. Sons of the Most High, Most Mighty, blah, blah, blah. Okay. You will therefore do well not to put in execution the letter sent by Haman, the son of Hamdata. What does the Megillah say? The Megillah says it's impossible for the king to write an order not to follow the order. So the stupid king, after he tells one group of citizens to murder the other ones, writes another letter. He says that this group of the other group of citizens should defend themselves and kill this first group of citizens instead of canceling the war. This makes the king out a little smarter. Right? He says, we got messed up over here. We hung the guy, he says in verse 18, right? And now, right, we want the Jews we want everyone to help the Jews to defend against anyone who tries to kill them, because we say don't kill them. Okay. Post a copy of the letter, give them reinforcements, etc. And as he finishes, in 24, every city that does not act accordingly shall be destroyed in wrath with spear and fire. It shall be not only impassable for men, but also more hateful for all time, to beasts and birds. Meaning, if any city does not fulfill my orders, right, then they will be permanently accursed. Now, this business over here, right, the second letter, right, so as we mentioned, is also, actually this is found parallels in the Targum, but they don't have all the details. I didn't find, maybe if I kept on going I might have found, but I didn't find a close parallel to this one. But the point I would make about this letter is that even though it's written in the most flowery Greek, it's anti-Hellenistic, because it fundamentally claims that the enemy of the Persian Empire is a Macedonian. Okay? So what has this story has done is something that we are very familiar with. Just as people make all these comments today about Haman and, Ahmadinejad or something like that, and the reason for these comments, or Hitler and Haman, the reason for all these comments is because of the eternal lesson of the story of Purim. And the way we handle that eternal lesson is to transfer who's an enemy of whom to every time. And as you see, they're already doing it here. And certainly we know that this festival was being observed during this time, because in 2 Maccabees, the day of Purim is referred to as the day of Mordechai. And the day of Mordechai was indeed the 14th of Adar, and people were observing Purim. So by that time, they must have understood the Purim story to refer not only to the original Persian non-Jews and their empire who sought to kill the Jews, but also to other enemies. Okay. Now, what I want to do now is sum up a little bit here, and then, believe it or not, have time for questions. I noticed that the style here is to talk as fast as you can to the very last minute, and then 5 minutes longer, and then whatever. But that's not necessary. Okay. So what I want to begin to simply review is a few points as follows. Number one, the purpose of these editions, all of them, is to answer the fundamental theological question that we all have that apparently existed in Hellenistic times as well. The Hellenistic answers to these questions are not far off, not much different than ones given in the later Midrashim, for two reasons. Either they represent consistent Jewish interpretive traditions, or in some case, because the Midrashim simply knew about these materials and either imported them or were influenced by them. It's tough to tell when it's one and when it's the other, but what you have to look for is the Hellenistic themes, if they're still there, and if you see them, you can be certain that there was some influence. Further, this entire text has taken the story of the Megillah, besides adding the missing religion, and it's placed the Megillah into the form of an eternal problem pertaining to the Jewish people and their non-Jewish neighbors. And in doing so, it has also transferred the issues of the Megillah to the classic issues of anti-Semitism, even though, the truth be told, the Megillah text's own statement represents a classical statement of anti-Semitism. Yeah? When you say, Yeshno am echad mefuzar meforad bein ha'amim v'datehem shonot mikol am, they're disloyal. They have dual loyalty. They don't follow they don't observe the tax laws. So anyhow, the bottom line is that anybody who takes a look at this sees here the preeminent anti-Semitic notion there. But since we know that this notion was intensified greatly in the Hellenistic period, we see here the reaction to it intensified. What I think, frankly, is the hardest thing to understand in what the material that I gave you is the dreams. The question is, why do we need the dream before, and why do we need the dream after? Now, it's possible that Josephus joined me in this question, and therefore left it out. If it were, in fact, in all the Greek texts that he had available, then Josephus made a decision to take it out. If, in fact, different Greek texts had different editions, and Josephus did not have the dream, then he made no such decision. But the possibility he made a decision is that Josephus doesn't go for this kind of magical heavenly history. He basically is on the way to modern history where one assumes that it's human. And even if God is to be thanked, the dreams and all this is just not his style. So having said that, I have to admit that I don't know the right answer, because it looks at what the dream is doing there is to tell us at the very beginning of the Megillah that God is involved. That's clear. But why does Mordechai have to know in advance what's happening? Because we don't see that his foreknowledge guides his behavior. Let me give you a parallel, and you'll see what I mean. In the Dead Sea Scrolls, in the Genesis Apocryphon, which is basically a midrashic rewriting of Bereshit, we find that the problem of why Abraham lied that his wife was his sister is solved by a dream. Guess what God tells Abraham to do in a dream? He takes the blame. He tells him to say that his wife is his sister, because otherwise Abraham will be killed. Abraham does it, and it doesn't work anyhow. But even though it doesn't work, God is literally taking the blame there. I told you to do it. Now the point is, there you see that as the story develops, it's intrinsic. Because the big deal of the story is that the king says to Abraham, why'd you do this? The king looks like he's not a bad guy. So why did you do this? It could have led to terrible troubles. And Abraham is left with no good excuse. So the dream is intrinsic to the new version of the story. Over here, if you take the dream out the way Josephus says, it all works fine. So I think the dream is a little bit of a puzzle. The rest of the stuff is not a puzzle at all. And that may answer another very important question. The dream is not in Esther Rabbah or other such authoritative Midrashic texts or Targumim. The dream exists in the Middle Ages in texts that floated around, that never had a great impact, and were found tucked in some manuscripts that could be found actually in the Vatican, right? And the dream never made it into Midrashic literature. The whole rest of it did. Now, as a final conclusion, I want to say that I think This shows us some very interesting things about the Hellenistic period. In the Hellenistic period, Jews were concerned about the problems of anti-Semitism very much as we are. That you could know from Appian and many other texts written by Josephus and many other authors. The anti-Semitism was an ongoing problem. The anti-Semitism that is talked about in the Megillah could easily be understood to be very much the same thing with very few changes, as unfortunately it could be very much the same thing as we've experienced in modern times, which is an amazing fact. Since the Megillah is the first example, of course we know that Philo, in his work on Flaccus, described the first economically based pogrom against Jews in Alexandria. So Jews in the Hellenistic period, like Jews later on, must have read this as a paradigm of anti-Semitism. But the religious issue, as we can see, was there all along. And our forefathers, in living either in the Hellenistic environment, we can't really know, or in Eretz Yisrael in their Hellenistic period, saw fit to make additions to the text to solve this problem and to give explanations that would basically make the Megillah even more readable and more understandable for their own time. And I would imagine that even those Jews who did not read the Megillah in Greek in the gigantic synagogue in Alexandria, when they did read the Megillah in Hebrew in Eretz Yisrael, were thinking of many of the same issues that are in these editions that we still think of today. So thank you very much, and we have 5 minutes for questions. But the rule is that anyone asks a question, they have to ask it loud. So anybody have a question? I don't want to repeat them. Yes, sir. That Haman was picking a day that was Independence Day. Yeah, you know, I don't know. I mean, this is not a bad idea, but you can't know. The one thing that I can tell you about this issue is that, you see, there are various stories that we have in Herodotus about the court intrigues and instability of the Persian Empire. And this story fits exactly into the types of things that went on. And the decision of Ahasuerus fits into the cruelty of the real Xerxes. And Xerxes, the real Xerxes, was also a terrible womanizer. He, among other people, had an affair with his sister and with his sister-in-law. He was not exactly the greatest guy. But the point that I make simply is this, that the intrigue of that whole empire is exactly what you're seeing here. And it fits perfectly into the circumstances. Other questions? Okay, thank you very much.